I'm Wilfred Brimley, and I'd like to talk to you for a few minutes about diabetes. Diabetes.
What is going on with our technical stuff?
Facebook.
We're blaming Facebook. I think it's Wirecast's fault, actually. So we have the technical difficulties are fixed. We're going to talk about diabetes, which, by the way, a diabetes is the singular of the plural diabetes, in case you're wondering. Thank you, Logan, for putting that on the screen. Today, I want to talk about a couple things. First of all, I want to hit us quickly with what is diabetes? Why is insulin life-saving in certain types of diabetes? And then what is pharma doing to drug pricing for insulin that is very similar to what's been happening with EpiPen, very similar to what's been happening with Narcan and other drugs like that, and what can we do about it? Because it is a serious, serious problem. Why don't we show us the article we're gonna talk about, Logan. Pull that up.
It got deleted.
It got deleted? Okay, so now we don't have that article, so I'm gonna read it to y'all. It's in Vox, and it says, insulin price hikes tell us a lot about what's wrong with drug pricing in America. Diabetics need insulin to stay alive. Increasingly, they can't afford it. So I'm gonna link to this article, and I should have done it in the title, so that you guys can read it afterwards. But basically, what it says is that insulin prices have been increasing out of proportion to inflation, and there are several reasons for this, and it's leaving diabetics high and dry. First of all, what is diabetes? Why do you need insulin? Okay, in the simplest bullet presentation, there are two types, largely speaking, of diabetes. Type one, and people get this mixed up. Oh, there's our article. People get this mixed up all the time. They treat type 2 diabetics and type 1 diabetics the same, and they assume type 1 diabetes is a decision of choice and lifestyle. It is not. Type 1 diabetes is when your pancreas, due to an autoimmune process, stops making insulin. You have no insulin, and insulin is a hormone that allows glucose to enter the cells of the body from the blood, muscle cells, liver cells, etc. If you don't have it, glucose builds up in the blood and causes a tremendous number of problems, damage to the organs, damage to the kidney, damage to the eyes, damage to the heart, and damage to the life, because you will die if it gets too high. You can get something called ketoacidosis and die from it. So type 1 diabetics, through no fault of their own, have an inability to produce insulin. They need external insulin, which has been around for at least 80 years, to save their lives. Without it, they will die. And they used to die. Now, and by the way, the term diabetes literally comes from the idea of sweet urine. In the old days, they used to diagnose it by tasting urine, and you could taste the sugar in it. I still do that, but that's mostly just a fetish of mine. It has nothing to do with science. Logan, hit me. Science! That being said, type 2 diabetics, more typically older in the adult range, type 2 diabetics have a problem not with producing insulin early on, they have a problem with being resistant to insulin. So even though they make insulin, their cells don't use it as efficiently, they become increasingly resistant to the insulin, and their sugars start to rise slowly. And often this is due to some lifestyle issues like obesity, diet, carbohydrate intake, etc. Some genetic issues. It's very familial, type 2 diabetes runs in families. And initially, the problem being insulin resistance, many diabetics can manage type 2 diabetes with medications like glyburide, which increases the amount of insulin that your pancreas produces. So you try to keep up with the resistance. Or something like metformin, which improves the sensitivity to insulin of the tissues. So two sort of facets of that. Now, as you start to increase, as you go through time, you can become increasingly insulin resistant, and then you need to take external insulin, just like a type 1 diabetic. So those are the case needs for insulin. Now, here's the thing. Insulin as a drug has been around for dozens of years. It used to be quite inexpensive. You inject it, you can't really take insulin orally, which has been a problem for many, many years. They tried an inhaled insulin, it had a lot of problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So now we have a situation where insulin prices, now remember, diabetics depend on this drug to save their lives, both type 1 and some type 2, keep rising. Why is this? If insulin has been around for so long, and here's what the article kind of goes through. The first issue is, oh, by the way, the guy who invented insulin discovered it in 1923, His name is Frederick Banting. He refused to put his name on the patent because he felt it was unethical for a doctor to profit off a discovery that would save lives. Isn't that interesting? So he just like gave it, he sold it to the University of Toronto for a dollar.
It reminds me of Jonas Salk not patenting the polio vaccine.
Right, didn't he say you can't patent a dream or something?
Like, he said you can't patent the sun, so he thought it was just a natural cure. He had just stumbled upon it.
By the way, when anti-vaxxers call vaxxers arrogant, that's a great example. I just invented the sun, bro, and you can't patent that. I love it, but it's true.
I mean, curing polio was a pretty big deal back in the day.
It's pretty dope. It's a pretty big deal now, actually, since polio is still a problem in part of the developing world. So now here's the punchline of this. Today, this guy who invented it might be spinning in his grave because 30 million American diabetics rely on insulin, and it's become the latest poster child for pharmaceutical price gouging. Eli Lilly, which makes Humalog and Humulin, which are big insulin products, raised the price by 7.8% on May 2nd. Okay, now, they're not acting alone because the other two companies that make insulin, Sanofi and Novo Nordisk, they're the only two other companies that make insulin. They've been jacking up their prices too. So three companies in the country make insulin, which, by the way, Americans use 15% of the world's insulin. They're 15% of the global insulin market, but they generate almost half of the pharmaceutical company industry's insulin revenue. So it tells you something is going on in the US, right? And what's going on is price gouging. There may be collusion between the three companies, nobody knows, right? But they have exceeded the rate of inflation even for unmodified insulin products. Now, why have they done this? They say, well, the typical pharmaceutical line of, well, it's innovation and constant research and that costs money. They have made incremental changes to insulins, okay, over the years compared to say the 90s. Incremental changes. Maybe they're a little bit better for some patients, but in general, the old school insulin works fine. No one makes the old school insulin anymore. So now you have the new school ones, which you have to order. They're still on patent and they cost a ton of money. So it may be, you know, $400 a month for a drug that is technically a century old. So all this being said, they, you know, this cost of innovation argument, is it valid or is it just another way to increase profits in a for-profit drug industry? And now there's arguments. Well, it's a free market. This is how the free market's behaving. Is it a free market though? And what's going on in the rest of the world? So in the rest of the world, why are the drug prices decreased? Because the payers for drugs are not individual insurance companies. They are typically the government in single payer systems. And in those systems, let's take an example for Great Britain. Great Britain negotiates as a block. They are the only customer for the drugs there. They negotiate as a block with the pharma companies. Therefore, they will say, this is the maximum price we're gonna pay. You either take it or you don't sell your drug in this country. And that works. It pushes prices down and et cetera. In the US, that is not how it works. The biggest payer, Medicare, right, is legally forbidden from negotiating drug prices with pharmaceutical companies. That's a problem. It negotiates individually with private insurers, so the rates may be all over the place, but with the biggest one, Medicare, for which all the prices are often pegged, it can't negotiate, has no negotiating power. Now, when you have a monopoly system situation or an oligopoly, as we know, three companies, they can set the prices, whatever it is. So the real reason why insulin prices are rising is because they can, because the drug companies are able to charge more. And as a for-profit institution that is dedicated to generating shareholder value, they have to do that. They almost have to do that. Right, Tom? I mean, would you agree?
I mean, I want them to do that, honestly. If I'm speaking purely elephant, I want them to, you know, I want them to get rich as long as they're actually creating new drugs.
Well, so the question is, does actually promoting a free market competition and capitalism within the drug company space promote innovation faster? And I would argue that's a mixed question because the problem is we have a lot of regulation in some sectors of drug development that make it very hard, and then no regulation in others. Like in pricing, it's just like, woo, do whatever you want. So the whole system is entirely unbalanced. I think there's probably smarter ways to manage drug prices and drug R&D and regulation that actually allow for competition and innovation while making drug prices much more affordable than they are. And the problem is there's an innate unfairness to some of the drug pricing. So certain drugs are less expensive, others are more. And a lot of these diseases, type 1 diabetes, it's through no lifestyle choice. Like, there's no moral judgment here. This is a person who has to have this drug, right? And they're never going to get, you know, 100% drug coverage. It's always going to be copays. There's always going to be other costs associated with it. So you're asking people to sacrifice a life-saving drug and maybe let their blood sugars run higher and suffer complications that ultimately end up costing the system and society more. The whole thing is a disaster.
Well, it does seem also intellectually dishonest to say that it's a free market when we have this 20-year patent window. That's not part of the free market.
Well, that's the thing. If you're going to put that much intellectual protection on it, right, you're going to stifle innovation in that sense. But you're also going to encourage it in one way, right, Tom? Because you're saying, okay, you figure this out, you get 20 years of a free pass.
Right.
And that's what the pharmaceutical industry will
argue. That's the idea behind it.
That's what they'll argue, is you get a free pass. But look, guys, like, we ought to be innovating constantly. We ought to have a billion small little companies all competing with each other for innovation. We ought to change how we sort of measure regulation, also how we test these drugs. The surrogate endpoints we use are whack. You know, we need to actually look at real outcomes, which takes bigger numbers, harder trials to do. We need big data and AI to help us with that. And that's going to be, I've always proposed this, Tom. I've said, like, if we actually spent all of Big Pharma's R&D budget for a year, just stopped research on everything, except for one thing. How to do research more efficiently, how to measure outcomes more efficiently. Spend a year doing that, get it nailed, then apply what you've learned to every problem humanity is facing from a medical side. You could actually exponentially speed up drug development. That's my theory. I have no evidence for it, but it just feels right to my elephant. The other things that they were talking about in this article are that some patients in January actually filed a lawsuit accusing the three companies of price fixing. So the American Diabetes Association, of which Wilfred Brimley is not a board member, has also asked Congress to investigate insulin price increases. So we'll see how this goes. Now, actually, Trump's people have made noises about pharmaceutical price regulation, which is interesting. So I got to see what ends up happening with that, whether there's any bite behind that threat. Let me see what else we got here. So, you know, when you think about EpiPens and other generic drugs like Narcan, you're in a very lax regulatory environment for prices. So if drug companies are able to find an angle to take an old HIV, anti-parasite drug and charge $1 billion for it, like, you know, Martin Shkreli wants to do, then they're going to do that, right? Because that's the nature of the market. They will charge what the market can bear. And so how do we manage that? And again, the rest of the world, they negotiate with drug companies en masse. We don't have that luxury in the U.S. yet.
Yeah, how's our innovation compared to other developed nations across the globe?
I would argue that in terms of innovation, most of the R&D and innovation is happening here, and other people will disagree with me. There's a lot in Israel, there's some in Europe, but really a lot of it happens here. But then if you look at where the money is actually being spent, that's because patients are getting charged a lot more in the U.S. because there aren't these negotiations between the government payer and the pharma companies. And so in the setting of that, again, since Medicare can't even negotiate drug prices, which seems to me crazy if the government is going to spend a bunch of money. Here's the problem, Tom, this is only a slight tangent. People always conflate like a single payer government plan with disaster because they know the government screws everything up that it touches, right?
Yeah.
But what if it didn't? What if it actually said, no, we're actually going to give you guys money and you're all going to compete for who can do it best with this money? And you get private industry and government in a partnership and they hold each other accountable. Like, could you imagine? It's hard to imagine it's gonna work because government is such an F up, right? And private industry will take advantage anywhere it can. But if you could do that, you could actually transform the entire healthcare system because government is already in 60% of healthcare. There's 60% of the payers between Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP and all that.
What I'm hearing is basically like, everybody knows that cats are assholes, but what if they weren't?
What if you could beat the cat into submission and make it behave and have it working with the dogs in collusion? I love that word collusion when we're talking about monopolies, to actually improve outcomes for animals across the farm.
Isn't that what they did with the prison systems? Privatized prison systems?
But is the government giving
the
prison
systems?
Doesn't
the government give the money?
But that's been a disaster, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that would happen in medicine and it would be a disaster. You'd have to figure out ways to do it. Here's a way that it's already happening. Medicare is a single payer plan for elders over 65. However, there are plans called Medicare Advantage where insurers can take money from the government in the form of Medicare payments for elders and actually compete for who can administer that money the most efficiently with the best outcomes and the most patient satisfaction. And those have shown some success. So you can see a public-private a hybrid like that, where there's competition, there's choice for patients, but there's also everyone is covered, and also the power and negotiating power of the government is behind it.
It makes me nervous.
It should.
My elephant doesn't like it at all.
It should make you nervous, but it still may be the answer. There are a lot of things that make me nervous. Nuclear bombs, Monchi cheese from the 80s, diabetes foot, as Logan says. That makes me very nervous, diabetes foot. So here's an interesting thing. So drug companies haggle separately over drug prices with a variety of private insurers across the country. Meanwhile, Medicare, the government health program, is actually barred from negotiating drug prices. So this is mentioned in the article, and that gives pharma more leverage. It leads to the kind of price surges we've seen with EpiPen, opioid antidotes, and now insulin. And here's, so this person, Elliot, who's quoted in the article, says, you're going to see people tapering off their insulin, using less insulin than they would, being willing to live at higher blood glucose levels than they otherwise might. This can lead to kidney failure, blindness, and even death, but that's how these price hikes manifest in patients. Let's talk about that for a second. Does raising the price of healthcare actually lead to decreased utilization? And the experience with high deductible healthcare plans argues that it does. But it doesn't do it in a way that's rational or actually good for patients. So if you throw an increasing deductible on patients, and these include physicians who should know better, they will start rationing their own care in a way that's not rational. So they will forego primary care visits, they'll forego preventative medicine. Insulin-using diabetics will try to taper their insulin to use the bare minimum to keep their sugars from getting them admitted to the hospital. But that's not enough to prevent you from losing a foot, getting an infection, losing your kidneys, losing your sight, or having a heart attack. And those are all the side effects of high glucose levels that aren't managed appropriately with insulin. So the problem with making patients financially accountable for healthcare stuff is that they will behave that way because that's the nature of how we see it playing out in the market. So there have got to be ways to make patients accountable when there are lifestyle choices involved, but it's not as easy as just raising prices on bad behavior. What do you think, Tom Heineberg? What do we got for comments?
I have a question for you about single payer. So in a single payer type system, are we like having a government agency that makes insulin at cost? Is something like that happening?
Well, no, I don't think it would be so much like that. It would be a government agency that pays, basically covers everybody. You can still have private insurers for people who want extra stuff, but all the private insurers, in my formulation, would compete with each other for that government money to manage patients. And the ones that do it the most effectively with the best outcomes for patients and that provide the highest sort of patient experience, those would be the ones that get the most money because most patients would gravitate to them because patients would still have choice. Everybody would be covered and you wouldn't have the problems that you have now where insurance companies don't want to invest in prevention because they know that patients only stay with them for 2 to 5 years. So why should they invest in preventing Logan's diabetes when Logan's going to be with United next month, right? And leaving Cigna.
Okay, that's so rude. Logan doesn't have diabetes.
Don't have diabetes
yet.
We have, Tom and I have diagnosed Logan with pre-diabetes.
I get checked regularly and I'm not pre-diabetic.
He got very butthurt when I accused him of being pre-diabetic for no reason. I was just like, it just feels right, Logan. And he's like, no, it's not right. I've been tested many times. I'm not pre-diabetic. I'm like, well, then you're pre-diabetic, all right? Because I just feel it. Mostly because Logan has a family history. And so I worry about that. And he often has a sweet Frappuccino in his hand, which makes me angry. By the way, Type 1 diabetics, do not get butt hurt. We are not accusing you of lifestyle related problems with causing your diabetes. Many type 1 diabetics, particularly teenagers, have trouble adhering to their insulin regimens and they have dietary indiscretion and they end up in the hospital with a flare, but it hasn't caused their diabetes, okay? So just understand that. I know a lot of moms, particularly of these kids, get very angry if we don't clarify that because there's a lot of misunderstanding in the world.
My dad's mom died of type 1. She was like 30.
Logan's dad's mom died of type 1 and she was 30. And type 1 is an interesting thing.
Back in like the 60s.
Back in the 60s. Yeah. So it's different, you know. They had old school insulin, which... Mm. Oh, so here's a question. That reminds me. Thanks, Logan. Type 1 diabetes actually, there's a genetic component, but the type 2 is... It has a lot of genetics in it, and it's multi-gene. It's not just one gene. So it has to do with lifestyle, it has to do with genetics, et cetera. The question is, why is pharma raising prices on insulin now? They argue that it's innovation, right? That they're making the molecules, they're changing an atom, and then they get a patent for another however many years. Do these drugs work a lot better than older insulins? Some endocrinologists will say yes for certain patients. Others will say, no, it's insulin. you take it. They have long-acting, you know, Detemer, Levemir, all those kind of insulins, right? Those are newer, and I understand those are different formulations. But when you change, you know, Humalog, that's a real different subject. It's a simple medication, really. So are we providing incremental benefit? And I would argue, I don't think it's worth the cost across the spectrum. You know, when again, when Americans are generating 40% of the pharmaceuticals revenues for insulin and using 50% of the world's global insulin supply.
And listen up, Pfizer. This is why the conspiracy theorists think that you have the cure for cancer and you're not giving it to people, because you just make a little incremental change and it's a money grab for you.
Yeah, and we can let Pfizer off the hook on this one because they don't make insulin. So.
Sorry, still, I went after you, Pfizer. We still cool? You sending that check?
Viagra. Though.
Pfizer, shill me, baby, after hours. Okay. I love you. What else we got on this? Where are we at here? Let's do some comments. 20 minutes.
Let's see. Jenny Gray says, physicians think that vitamins and herbals are beneficial in treatments. They say it's quackery. Let's see. Susan Robinson says, insulin is made through GM tech now, right? That is more expensive to make.
It is and it isn't. I mean, it used to be a biological process. I mean, I don't think that's a compelling argument. And pharma people can weigh in if you work for a pharma company in the R&D and tell us why it's more expensive. My medication in Australia, says Amy Stroud, is $6.70 a month, Australian dollars, for more things. In America, they're between $400 and $600 a month. Right. But Amy, where is that? So here's a question. The pharmaceutical companies have to make their profit somewhere. They're making it on Americans. If we shut it down, what's going to happen? So the pharmaceutical companies will argue, well, research and innovation will plummet, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I argue will happen is the big pharma companies will fall apart. Smaller, more nimble companies that are hopefully less regulated, because we have to change regulation, would spring up to nimbly develop drugs at a lower cost but quicker without all the overhead. And if we did that more efficiently, we might have a more efficient system that could be delivered worldwide.
Let's see. Sue says, what about the diabetic patients that inherited the diabetes? I lost over 95 pounds and still did not lose the diabetes. My three sisters, my mother, her siblings, and her father all have or had diabetes. So that's probably type 1, right, that Sue's having?
Well, no. So she's saying she lost a bunch of weight and the diabetes persisted?
Yes.
Yeah, so that can happen in type 2, because what can happen is, number one, there is a genetic component. There are very thin people who get type 2 diabetes as well, especially Chinese people. Asians, they have a situation called skinny fat, where they're hiding fat in their peritoneum. You don't really see it. Their weight overall is fine. Their BMI is fine, but they are diabetic, and it's a genetic insulin resistance issue. Also, very intolerant of a Western-type diet. The high carbs and refined processed food is not good for them. That can happen in type 2, and you can lose weight. Sometimes type 2 can get so out of the barn that you really do burn out your pancreas, and by that time, even if you lose a bunch of weight, it's always better for you. You're going to lower your medication doses, but you're not going to totally reverse this diabetic state. Okay, so it's not a, that's why, and it doesn't necessarily mean you have type 1.
And I think the reason so many people want to make the distinction in the comments between type 1 and type 2 is because type 2 is seen as some sort of a moral failing, and type 1 is not in our society.
Well, and this is true. And let's talk about that for a second. I want to unpack that for a second. Type 2 is seen as a moral failing. Is it a moral failing to inherit the genetics for type 2 from your family? No. Is it a moral failing to live in a society that has fast food on every single corner, that encourages a high-carb, low-fat diet, that encourages us to be sedentary in front of screens?
Also, your big daddy government that you love told everybody to eat all those breads, grains, carbs. They're like the top three things on their stupid food pyramid.
Yeah, and who forced big daddy government to do that? Big agriculture and big food and big corn that gets subsidies from our Midwest, those Big Macs though. Our Midwest farm lobbies. So you can see it across the board. It is public and private problem. And it can, believe me, Tom Heinever, I've worked at the VA. I am no fan of Big Daddy government. We can do it a lot better if we have proper public-private partnerships holding each other accountable. We haven't seen that yet happening. I love this bald man, says Chris Warren. I assume that's me, or you could be talking about my cousin Vin Diesel. But pharma isn't listening. They don't care. They're just counting their money on their yachts, with a slanty face Bell's palsy emoji.
Brenda says, thank you for acknowledging that the deck is stacked against our staying at a healthy BMI.
It really is. So we were talking about moral failing. So type 2, is it a moral failing then to be a part of this society? That means that 30% of Americans that are overweight, et cetera, that they all have moral failings? I would say we're in a, look, if you have elephant, unconscious desires, writer, our little planner that's really just a press agent for the elephant, and the path we're walking on. When the path is freaking filled with Snickers and big gulps and Frappuccinos full of sugar, and everybody's telling you, hey man, cut the fat, bro, or you're gonna die, and then they're telling you, hey, your desk job is here, what's gonna happen to you? You're gonna get fatter and fatter and fatter. And yes, choice is a part of it, but is it really in the end? You know, Tom, I don't believe in free will. I think we're kind of conditioned creatures that behave automatically. Our conditioning is effed up. It's effed up. So yes, there is some choice in that, but it's a bigger systemic issue. We didn't have this epidemic of type 2 diabetes back in the day when we were out doing exercise, doing stuff, and we had to pretty much grow our food. Right?
This will lead into Chris's question about what the keto diet is, but I'm sort of doing the low carb thing right now. I went to Chipotle earlier, I ordered meat, guac, cheese, and I had the girl like just drown it in sour cream. And she looked at me like that was the craziest, most unhealthy choice I could make.
Well, I think going to Chipotle may be the craziest, I'm not sure about unhealthiest, unless you want to get, you know, dysentery, which appears to be quite common. It's increasingly felt that it may not be, and this is a controversial topic we've talked about before and we will talk about again. But relating to diabetes, I think part of the reason we're seeing this overall epidemic is that it has been a shift to a higher carbohydrate, refined sugar, processed food diet that has promoted people who have genetics that are susceptible to it. Look, I was pre-diabetic. I was literally pre-diabetic, not like my imagined state for Logan. I had a hemoglobin A1C of 5.7 or something, right in the pre-diabetic range, right? And I started cutting out refined sugar, eating, you know, whole grains, and then cutting some of those out too, and doing intermittent fasting. And now my hemoglobin A1C is 5, and I feel great. And I check my blood sugars, and they're all fine. My fasting sugar used to be 99, like right there on the border.
Can I just say that since I've been doing the low carb thing, I feel great physically, but I feel shitty emotionally. Cause I just like, I don't get any of the foods from my childhood that used to make me feel good. I walk around, there's so many things I see that I wanna eat. It sucks.
Well, so this is the thing about food. It tells you something about food's effect on our mind, our emotions, our sense of well-being. And I think that's part, it relates a little bit to Dr. Wanda Filer's episode the other day on adverse childhood experiences. Adverse childhood experiences, trauma, sexual abuse, et cetera, have been associated with adult obesity. And the question is why? Well, people are either using food as a comfort mechanism or as a defense mechanism. Some young people who suffer sexual abuse eat to make themselves unattractive so that they can be safe from the sexual abuse. It's really horrible. So food is a powerful, in human culture, I mean, remember, we're evolved to eat. Food is a powerful emotional and psychological stimulant and crutch, and that's why it can be very hard to lose weight, very hard to get these things under control.
And just culturally, you know, like cheeseburger and fries, that's like a just go-to meal for me, and now I can't eat it.
Yeah, right, and me too. When I started the sort of, and I'm not a ketosis guy. I did that for a while, and I realized it wasn't good for my mental state because it was hard to socialize and hard to maintain. And I thought about food all the time because I was thinking about it from the science of it. Like, okay, well, I don't want to go out of ketosis by eating this, but just having a moderately low carb, just a normal carb diet. Because I think what it is, the U.S. diet is just too high carb. And vegetarian diets tend to be higher carb, and some people tolerate them fine. There's no one size fits all. But for me, it was really about just kind of moderating something that would be sustainable.
Cheryl wants to know, if you want to cut out sugar, should you taper down or go cold turkey? My opinion is cold turkey. What's your opinion?
Yeah, I think cold turkey.
Because you'd also be surprised how much sugar is in stuff you wouldn't even think is sugar.
It will shock you if you try to cut out, just all you got to do is cut out actual sugar. Like anything with added sugar, and you will find that 70% of your diet goes away and you've got to eat things totally differently, because most processed food, a lot of drinks, bread has actual added sugar, honey, and you got to look at sugar in all its guises.
Most sauces.
Look at it in all its guises. High fructose corn syrup, honey, purified cane juice. Those are all, you know, the synonyms for sugar.
Also different grains, everything.
Yeah. Well, the grains are complex. So if I'm saying cut out refined sugar, then we're just cutting out those simple carbohydrates. The grains can have simple carbohydrates, but they won't necessarily be pure sugars.
Tracy Dawson says milk. Yeah, milk has like 17 grams of sugar.
Dude, milk is the worst. And what we've been doing, and again, I'm painting with a broad palette. Some individuals really do well with dairy and milk in particular, but we've been telling people skim milk, low fat milk. And all that does is take the fat out, which takes away the ability to fill you up and make you feel full. And you just have basically sugar water with some protein and calcium in it, which a lot of people need the protein and calcium, or mostly the calcium, because Americans' diet is pretty high in protein. But they don't need all the sugar, and the fat allows satiety. Also, if you get like, there's some data, some preliminary data that organic milk, because the cows are eating better, they may be eating grass-fed milk, has a saturated fat profile that may be a little less inflammatory. This is still early research.
Tammy says that fruit is natural sugar. That's true, Tammy, but if you take like a glass of orange juice, that's unnatural. It's just like drinking a Coke.
Yeah, well,
because you've destroyed the fiber.
This is the thing with juicing. So people are like, I juice, bro. So it's totally awesome. Okay, so let me understand. When God makes a toxin, he wraps it in the antidote a lot of the times. So he takes fructose, which is fruit sugar, and puts it in an apple pectin matrix, which is fiber and water and other things in that matrix that slow its absorption so it doesn't overwhelm the liver and get turned immediately into fat in the liver. When you juice, you grind up the matrix, release the fructose juice, and get it all in a massively quickly absorbed bolus, in which case your blood sugar goes crazy, you get hungrier, you have insulin secretion, over time generates insulin resistance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you end up overpaying for these damn insulin drugs, which brings the entire thing full circle. I am so brilliant. I hurt myself sometimes. I'm also stupid. Tom, what do you think? Any other good comments?
I think I want some carbs, like right now.
Let's go to Chipotle and just get a carb bowl with rice and nothing but beans.
Listen,
and then put sugar on it.
We're about to take our pre-diabetes to just pre-diabetes, you know what I'm saying?
I get lettuce and steak and chicken and no sour cream or cheese.
I
just want to let you know that.
I just
when
know.
When I go to the Chipotle.
I know, Logan.
And it's a bowl, or it's a salad.
Logan, you're going to. You're going to. I don't know why the camera's
the
still
show
on me.
Is over. Take us out, Z.
We are so out of here, Wilford Brimley says diabetes.
I'm Wilford Brimley, and I'd like to talk to you for a few minutes about diabetes. Diabetes.
Human walrus, y'all. And we're out.
I hate you so much. Bye.
Uh-huh.